is hungry. All kinds of elevations of a state are blind and meaningless unless the elevation causes the individual to become a better servant of humanity. Wherever promotion results in increased finance and privilege and no responsibility, bad karma is not far away. All the way along, everything we do has to be estimated in terms of consequence. If we have children, we have to take the time to educate them. If we have a proper job, we must do it well. We cannot shoddy our work without ultimately causing karma. And if enough people shoddy their work, it is almost impossible for any of us to get a piece of work done honorably. This is not because the devil has been whispering in ears all the way along. It is simply because we are all setting the example to each other. And for the most part, the example at the moment is not good. So we have to begin this way, to really try to find out what is possible to us, so that we will not make these karmic decisions that hurt us. We should so live that as we drift through the years of life, that we have as much peace and harmony as possible, and continue to be as useful as possible. The perfect life is the useful life. The idea that success is to avoid or evade responsibility and labor. These are fictitious ideas. Karma will punish the individual who believes that what he has should be kept in his own pocket as long as he lives. All these things represent misuses of things. And karma is the great pageantry of use and misuse. Now we look around a little bit and we find people who are doing very lovely things, very beautiful things, very wise things. Now this does not mean that these wiser people don't suffer a little. Everyone suffers in an unfinished universe. But it means that in compensation for a misfortune, there is such an internal enlightenment that the misfortune loses nearly all of its tragedy. The individual who does the best he can, really and honorably, when faced with a responsibility, is given unusual resources. Sometimes he prays for divine help, but the prayer is backed by his own integrity. And if those work together, the job is liable to become solved or the problem be met. So all these things relate so definitely to human conduct and personal integration that it seems that we should give this matter a great deal of careful thought and try to find ways in which we can cure this mysterious disease of indifference and lassitude with which most people seem to be suffering. We talk to folks every day, and we find more and more people are dissatisfied with the actions of their associates. The individual, even though he is not honest himself, objects to the dishonesty of others. He is looking for a better world, even though he is contributing nothing to produce it. So here we have about 5 billion, somewhere near 5 billion human beings living on a small ball in space. Now, this little assemblage, which looks very big to us, does not look very big from a constellation far off. It is because it's a little molehill on which we live. But here we are with lessons to learn. And these lessons are first-grade instruction in the ruling of the cosmos. If somewhere along the line, as some schools of philosophy believe, our evolution will ultimately result in our becoming part of a great evolutionary program that will come into existence in the future, that each one may have an executive place in the great unfoldment of the constellations and stars and elements. If this be true, and it may be, we can't say it won't be true, then this is part of our educational field. Here we are trying to solve a very simple problem, a problem that is not beyond our capacity. We want to live quietly and peacefully. We want to have enough to take care of ourselves respectably and with reasonable pleasantness. We want to get along with each other in amity. We want to have our beliefs respected, and in time we will learn to respect the beliefs of others. We want a harmonious, pleasant world. And when two people out of this hope both marry, they expect to live or hope to live in a happy and harmonious family. They want the things to happen immediately which are the greater good for all concerned. They are perfectly willing, if they care, to do something to motivate the good and well-being of others. Now, reforms nearly always start not with pure intellection, but very largely with emotion. Actually, we get further by the love of truth than we trying to understand it. The moment our affections are warm, kindly, and friendly, and we recognize the natural and inevitable tie between all living things, when this begins to sink into our consciousness, we find that love takes the place of law in many things. But love is a fulfillment of law and not an escape from it. If love is real, the law will not be broken. If love is unreal, the law will be broken. And if the law is broken, the love will fail. This is all part of a very big pattern. But the kindness of heart, unselfishness, integrity, values, peace, and affection, responsibility, recognition, and admiration for achievement. All these things are part of building a world in which the law of cause and effect is going to produce the results we most want. We want to live in a world which is right, but we have to cause right, or it will not happen. We pray to heaven to solve our problems, but heaven does not solve things that way. Heaven determines that each individual must have the vital experience of solving his own problems. Now, we all feel, you know, that there's something that can get us out of our difficulties. And we like to think that perhaps religion will do it. Well, religion will do it if that religion inspires us to do it for ourselves. If, on the other hand, this religion promises us freedom from the responsibilities we deserve, or will not acknowledge the correction of the proper mistakes, if the religion throws all burdens on the Lord and lets the individual do as he please, then we will continue into the future with exactly the problems we have today. To solve problems is a job. It is a profession. It is a dedication. It is an inevitable duty. Now, working with people a great deal, as we have, we find out some problems that are comparatively frequent. One of the most common problems, I guess, today is this problem of dissatisfaction with world conditions. We don't like things the way they are. We don't like bombings. We do not like to have terrorist groups wandering about the earth. We hope and desire to have a normal and reasonable kind of existence. Now, why don't we have this? It's because we have not built it into the contracts between nations. We have not said that a treaty is finally a bondage of integrities. When the United Nations meets, it should meet with each candidate, each member, dedicated to truth, and not coming down with the information given him by some military dictator in the background. We cannot have any of the things we want without integrities. And chaos is the karma of lack of integrity. It is what happens when nobody does it right. Now, a lot of people want to do it right, but the interferences are hard to face, are hard to cope with. So we can say that the best chances for doing it right are among people who have dedicated themselves to a self-improvement, who are seeking in one way or another to grow, to be better, not in order that they may dominate others, but in order that they may enlighten themselves. If we recognize a divine principle, at the core of our own existence. If we know that there is a God in us, and that this God within us is part of the inheritance that we have from space, we have within ourselves an inevitable power for right. We have within ourselves the capacity to grow, to enlighten ourselves, to perfect our own temperaments and dispositions, and to do those things which are most useful to our world. This is in us. It is the seed of the everlasting, sowed in the earth of the transitory. It is that which is our proper and inevitable mystery of the seed, the mustard seed, which, though the smallest of all seeds, grows into a great tree for the shelter of the birds and for shadow and shade for human beings. So our enlightenment coming from the divine seed within ourselves has to be one way or another developed. It has to be developed sometimes against a lot of adversities. And we may assume at the present moment that most people reaching maturity have not had necessary instruction in this particular area. They have grown up under a system which is largely materialistic and therefore is continuing with all the old problems. It has grown up in a narrow atmosphere and an atmosphere of self-centeredness, even though it has been comparatively moderate in its ambitions. But it has not been a dedication to purpose. I think that we should recognize the importance that every young person growing up should in some way or another be aware of a sacrament, and not one of the sacraments that we generally acknowledge in the church, but the sacrament of dedication. That just as surely as we have baptism and we have the sacrament of marriage, confession, absolution, Eucharist, all these things, that we also have the sacrament of dedication. Not a sacrament to become a clergyman, but a sacrament to dedicate life to its essential purpose. That somewhere along the line, each individual should come face to face with the realization of the natural responsibilities that are his in life. And actually, ancient people had this. It's strange that it was one of the things that dropped out. But back in the very early days of civilization and into some of the more recent Oriental systems, a child was not born a citizen. This is very important thinking. A child was not born as a citizen, and it had only a milk name. In other words, it had a child name. It grew up in the family with this child name, and in Egypt, the child wore a lock of hair, sort of twisted down over the eye, and the rest of the head was bald, shaven clean. But this lock was the child lock, and at a certain period, in a certain time in its life, the child was taken to the temple with all the ceremony necessary, with all the relatives and friends, the whole community in the cheering area, taking care of making this a festive occasion. And at this moment, the child, now old enough to make a personal decision, usually in the middle or later teens, took the oath of obligation to his world. He was transformed from a child to a person. This was true also of women. It was not limited to men. This was a right of citizenship. The person who dedicated himself to the service of good, who offered his life for the protection of his family, his community, and his world, became a citizen. He became a citizen by accepting the responsibilities of adulthood. He became a citizen by becoming an example of right in his community. He was a dedicated and sanctified person, living to fulfill the real reason for a human being's existence. Then his child lock was cut off, and his name was given to him, his grown-up name, a name that indicated his place in the tribe. And when this was given to him, He took his oath of obligation to the tribe, and when the tribal members met, he sat with them. He was part then of the family to which he belonged. Not the just family of his own house, but the family of the clan, the tribe, the group of which he was a member. And for that group, he was dedicated to live to serve it and to die to save it if necessary. There was no longer any of this going off by yourself to make it rich or something of that nature. It was all part of a system. Because without this consecration, antiquity could never have survived. It survived because everyone stood firm for that which the tribe stood for. And the tribal was wisdom, the orender of the tribe, descended from the heroes of the past who had given their lives to make the present possible. They had gone out and sacrificed everything so that their descendants could have a better life. And it was the privilege and right of these improving descendants to honor the virtues that they had inherited and protect them for the future. Now, this citizenship of the tribe is a very interesting and important thought, at least. It changes the whole aspect of things. The young individual is not out to make his own way primarily. He will make his own way in all probability, because his dedication doesn't make him useful or useless. It makes him useful. It makes him able to live a better person himself, to do his job better, and at the same time always remember his relationship to the group and his part in their success. So this type of thinking was part of a cure for what we might term cause and effect as we know it today. If we had brought forward the causes of good, if we had brought forward the wisdom of antiquity, we would not now be in this particular condition. The attitude or belief that we should forget the past and live in the glorious present and make it worse in the future is not very successful. It's not going to do much for us, but it's going to do a lot to us if we do not gradually recover from the present attitudes. So when then comes the idea of what happens when you do it right? Well, when you do it right, you see gradually the good of the human being, the good of the neighbor, and the achievement of the human brotherhood, which has been the great teaching of religion since the dawn of time, becomes possible. We can be one family. Not because we all agree with each other, but because all of us agree with principles under which we live. We believe in the right of the other person just as much as our own. We do not step on the liberties or values of other people, but we tread carefully upon their weaknesses and try to help to strengthen the life of the person. We are here as a family. And this family has collective karma just as well as it has individual karma. And the condition we see today is simply the inevitable outcome of long abused privileges, long wasted resources, and the continuing emphasis upon selfishness. Now, many people feel there's nothing left but to be selfish, and they hope that the end of their lives will release them from this wheel of Ixion upon which they have crucified themselves. This is not necessarily true, however, because the law of karma is also correlative with reincarnation or rebirth. And rebirth is simply the opportunity to complete unfinished business. And business is always unfinished until the individual attains enlightenment. Enlightenment is the final victory of the internal over the external aspects of life. It is the victory of God over the misuses which we have associated with religion, science, philosophy, and the arts. Actually, reincarnation is the next step in this tremendous road that we all have to follow. Reincarnation is another day in school. It is another opportunity to grow. and all we have accomplished today in this life are brought forward from previous existences. All these virtues and strengths become part of a new standard of education. The time must come and is coming when education must take on its final purpose, namely that education is necessary to fit the individual to become part of a great motion of life to which he belongs, a motion which leads through time and space to final identity with the cosmic integrity. It has to do with the fulfillment of all things. It has to do with the achievement of a purpose for life. That is one of the problems we have. We have more doctors we know what to do with. We have more attorneys than we need. We are now developing the largest following of computer operators that will be necessary in the next 2,000 years. By that time, there won't be any computers. All of these rather foolish things show how we will take time and energy and go through universities or take crash courses all to get $2 an hour more on the paycheck or to get a job or something of this nature. We will do much for physical security, but nothing for the integrities upon which life and physical security must ultimately depend. We must begin to realize that we have to grow. And growth is an acceptance of realities. We grow when we can take an event in our own lives, dissect it, and find what it means. We can do a certain amount of growing if we take a mistake, which we have nursed for a long time, gradually learn to know why it is a mistake, and decide not to repeat it. We can use our own lives as handy textbooks and reference works about things we need to know. We have to do this type of thing, or else continue to drift along in the uncertainties which most people suffer from, and at some time these uncertainties catch up to them and make them pretty miserable. So the rich man who died takes nothing with him but what he has learned. And if he has devoted enough time to material investments and banking, he's not going to be much good in a different world where these do not exist, or even this world if he comes back when they are no longer practiced. We have to build enough of the now to protect ourselves in daily living. But we must also build in enough of tomorrow to serve us when tomorrow comes. We must do what is necessary to make this life useful, necessary, and helpful. But we must also be laying the foundations for future lives in which better values will become the basis of better living. In India and other parts of the Orient, the law of karma is just simply accepted so completely that no one really doubts it. It's not something you have to argue about or convert someone to. To the Oriental mind, it is the only reasonable answer. What help? What else is there reasonable for the individual to work with? There is a possibility that he doesn't survive, and that there is nothing. That when he passes on, good and bad cease together, because he has ceased. Now, in a universe which has gone through as much as this one has in the last 1 or 2 years, it seems rather foolish to announce that everything is ending in nothing. That all this great struggle should mean that each individual shall pass on, never know again what happened, and never have an again in himself. He simply ceases to exist. The materialists have tried to make this look attractive by suggesting that we leave behind us our memories, our achievements, and some kind of a memorial to our accomplishments. But if we do not even live to know that this has happened, there's very little real satisfaction in ceasing to exist, even if we are represented by a stone here on this planet. The next thing is, what about the future? Do we go to some abstract place, better or worse, where we must face the consequences of our actions? Where if we are wrong, we are punished. If we are virtuous, we are punished also unless we belong to the right group that gives us a certain survival. But we get there, and what is there? There is nothing but a vast ghost land of suffering and misery. Individuals punished for things they did not know enough to avoid. Millions who had not been very bad or very good, suffering together in some cruel limbo under the domination of an infernal power which should have never had a place in a God-given universe. If this is forever and ever, and that the individual is going to suffer in this respect, I think it's high time for most people to come to a rather simple solution. If this is true, we're not going to believe it anyway. We're going to refuse to accept eternal damnation for the transitory mistakes of modern human ignorance. We might need a chastising, someone just slap us on the wrist or something. But this idea of eternal damnation is certainly no longer acceptable to a conscious or intelligent human mind. They also have other possibilities as to the joining with the right church or something, that we have a better opportunity over there, a better consideration. But the fact remains, the whole thing is frustration. The whole thing ends with the simple fact that the average individual leaves this world not bad enough to go to hell and not good enough to go to heaven. Under such circumstances, the answer is inevitable. The only thing to do is come back here and finish it. Nowhere out in space is there anyone that wants us. And it's now getting to the point where we don't want each other here. But the only answer is the idea that reincarnation is an opportunity for the individual to overcome his weaknesses, develop more strength of character, become a more positive and constructive factor in the plan of things, and go on until his enlightenment carries him beyond the phases of pain and sorrow which we know on this planet. We need to have this encouragement. We need to have the idea of what is going to happen. And in order to know what is going to happen, the law of karma and law on reincarnation have been linked together, because the reincarnation is the solution to the imperfection of human life. And karma is the pressure behind the individual to help him to outgrow his mistakes. The pressure of the discomforts of wrongdoing. These are the pressures that karma works with. There is nothing ugly, unpleasant, terrible, or tragic about the operations of karma. Karma is by nature kindness, because it is forever providing new opportunities for the completion of unfinished business. It helps us to be sure that in the due course of things, we shall also develop the consciousness that is necessary to us. Now we may also ask, if this be the case, what about what happens? What are the laws of karma bringing about in the larger pattern of things? What is it that lies beyond for which we are trying to perfect ourselves? Well, in the first place, the perfection of self is really simply a natural necessity. That we should unfold our potentials is part of potential itself. The reason why this plant grows is because the seed is planted. And each life is a part of the growth of something. Now, when we plant a seed of a tree, why do we plant it? It's because we hope it will grow into a tree. And we hope that that tree will have a reason for existence. Because we know also that in that tree will be also the perpetuation of itself. Now, the fact that these growths are all continuous seems to indicate a universe of unfolding integrities and values. That somewhere in the large mystery of things, the separated being, that part of the divine nature which was isolated in the creation, and is scattered now through every form of living thing, from man to the smallest cell or atom, that all this, as Pythagoras points out, will be gathered up, and that in this great moment, when all these sparks become one again, on that occasion, the divine being, who is made up of these sparks, will become alive again. We resurrect or save the divided energies of God, return them to their source, and the divine power is fulfilled, completed, and made perfect by the constant contribution of its parts. When all things gather together, God blazes forth in the certainty of itself. It blazes forth as the perfection of all things. The sparks return to the flame. And all that is not part of the sparks and not part of the worldliness is absorbed again into the essences from which these things came. So that in the end, we are really all a great, eternal, divine power growing up in the multitude of imperfect sparks, gradually becoming liberated from the limitations of matter, and finally returning again to the infinite splendor, which is our true nature and substance. What we are going to feel, how we're going to think, or what we're going to do when we are again part of the infinite is rather beyond us at the present time. But we know that it is in the keeping of an eternal power, and that the end of all things is perfection. Nothing is lost. There is nothing that can exist that isn't part of this growing thing that must ultimately become perfect in its own right. Consequently, we are all working in a sense, maybe, to rescue the separated parts of the eternal and bringing them together, returning the infinite diversity to once more to complete an eternal unity. That we are working all the time for the salvation of the one life that exists in this world. For the universe itself is suspended from one life, and this one life is clothed in the universe. And the perfection of this one life through the perfection of its parts is the absolute and abstract resurrection. It is the final release of eternal life from the limitations of form. But this life being thus released brings with it something that it could never have had it not divided into its parts, had these parts gradually grow up and become part of itself. But when they become part of itself, then these parts in their own right will know what makes eternity itself, what creates the final and ultimate. And when it's returned to the infinite, it shares the wisdom, the love, the hope, and the eternity of the great power from which it came. In other words, the return to God is a perfection through effort, a return of the part of the spark to the flame. And that is not a dead loss, a dead silence, a dead deepness somewhere, but that in some mysterious way, when we reach that ultimate union, we will discover that we are in the presence of a creating, created divine power which functions on one principle alone, and that is love. All hates, fears, doubts, beliefs must finally be absorbed in love. For love is that which fashions all things. The lack of that love has given us our present disasters. And we must finally find our way back again to union with that power, which is infinite love. And in so doing, share in that love. And war and sorrow and strife will be no longer in us. And we will be part of that eternity for which we were created, and to which we must continually aspire. Thank you very much.